Hello, survivalists. This is the Crux True Survival Story Podcast. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh, joined by the one, the only, Julie Henningsen. Hello, Julie.
Hi, Casey. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm really excited to hear whatever story you have for us today.
I'm going to share with you today the survival story of Sławomir Rawicz. He was a Polish army lieutenant born in 1915. And this is one of the most incredible survival stories that I have ever heard or read about, including all of the previous episodes we talked about. This one's a real doozy.
Wow. That's saying a lot.
Today, we're going to step back to the mid-20th century amidst the tumult of World War II and the aftermath that ensued. The focus of our story today rests on the remarkable survival story of Sławomir Rawicz. Prepare to be transported across landscapes, unforgiving Siberian wilderness, treacherous peaks of the Himalaya. Rawicz's journey, alongside several others, defies the bounds of human imagination. They'll confront hunger, frostbite, and the ever-looming specter of capture. Lace up your virtual boots today, dear listeners. We are going to tread the footsteps of courage and perseverance as we learn about the survival of Sławomir Rawicz.
I have chills already, Julie. When you said frostbite, chills. Also, the ever-looming capture. Also, that gives me chills.
Yes, yes. This is a pretty unbelievable story. Rawicz was born in 1915, Sławomir Rawicz. We're going to call him Slav. That's easier to say. And that's what his friends called him.
Oh, I like it.
He was a Polish army lieutenant. He served in the Polish army and was ultimately imprisoned and accused of spying after the German-Soviet invasion of Poland in 1939. So he was arrested at his home in Poland in November 1939, just following Poland's defeat to Nazi Germany and Russia. He was accused of being a spy. And upon his arrest, he was taken to several prisons, kind of transported several times, ending up in a prison called Lubyanka, which sounds like an awful place to end up in every aspect. During his time while he was imprisoned awaiting trial, he was tortured pretty much on a daily basis. He was starved. He was confined. He was placed in a room that was like the size of an upright coffin. So it was just, you know, big enough for somebody to stand in, but not big enough to sit in. And he would be locked in that room by himself, sometimes for days at a time. No bathroom facilities. It sounds just horrible. He was beaten. He was tortured with hot wax, like all these terrible psychological torture techniques that were all being used to try and just get him to confess to being a spy. So somehow throughout this ordeal, he resisted giving in and confessing. He knew in his heart that if he signed a confession, it would mean his death. And he right. had this resilience to kind of put up with all he was going through in hopes that he could avoid death. So he just somehow powered through.
So, Julie, do you know if he actually was a spy? And do you have any idea why they suspected him to begin with?
So I think he wasn't a spy. I mean, he really is adamant that he wasn't. And kind of what he has said is that he lived and grew up near the border, near the Polish-Soviet border. There were a few instances where he suggested that, hey, if you lived in that area and you were in the Polish army, they just sort of assumed you were a spy.
Oh, okay.
And it sounds like this was a really common thing for people with his kind of demographic profile, young men who were in the Polish army, especially living where he did. There were thousands of other men in this pretty much same situation that all were kind of wrongfully accused. And it sounds like, you know, people on both sides probably knew that it was a wrongful accusation and the whole thing was just some kind of a big, you know, power play or kind of rigged farce to try and flex a little bit on the part of the Soviets.
Control and manipulate.
Exactly. Yeah, control and manipulate. So Slav had one torture session that in particular that he woke up the next day and couldn't really remember the details of what had happened. And he had been given some sort of unusual food product the day before that, of course, he was eager to eat, but it was out of the ordinary. So he kind of came to the conclusion that he had probably been drugged. And then he was worried that during this gap in memory, when he was, you know, in this altered mental state, he may have signed a confession and just didn't remember
it.
So that was on his mind. And finally, after months of this, he went to trial. And the whole trial was just a big circus, a big farce, completely rigged. They put him on the stand and were accusing him of knowing all these people he didn't know and doing all these things he didn't do, and basically just really didn't even let him get a word in edgewise. You know, like he realized pretty early on that it would be useless to try and defend himself. Even his assigned defender assumed him to be guilty and treated him as such. So it was just a big disappointment. And at one point at the end of the trial, they produced a document and gave it to him and said, "Is this your signature?" It was a confession. And what? Slav looked at the document, and it was his signature.
No.
Yeah. So he concluded that he must have signed it during that time that he was drugged.
So what was the point of the trial? That's what I wonder. Like, why even bother to put him through trial when you already know what the conclusion is?
Yeah. Just exactly. And everybody knew that that's what the conclusion was going to be. There was no two ways about it. So it was just a performance, like a circus show, you know,
just so they can say, hey, look, we give people fair trials. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yep. You got it. So after this signed confession, which I'm air quoting, was produced, of course, there was no other hope for his situation. He was sentenced to 25 years hard labor in a Siberian prison camp, which you may know is called a gulag. Ooh. So he was sent to the gulag for 25 years, and he was 25 years old at that time. So as long as he'd been alive, he was looking at hard labor in this Eastern Siberian prison camp.
Absolutely horrible.
Yeah, right. And you would think his spirit must be crushed at this point. But Casey, our story is just getting started. Pretty unbelievable what happens next. So kind of the next chapter is all about how did he get from this Lubyanka prison area to Eastern Siberia? Well, he and about 4,500 other sentenced men in similar situations as his were transported like livestock, first crammed into train cars, again, standing up, no bathroom facilities for days at a time, just going down the tracks, no food, no warm clothes, and no, you know, breaks to even be let out of this train car, often, you know, for multiple days. They would change positions within the car, like this rotation system, so everyone got a chance to stand near the edge where there were kind of wooden slats holding them in, and they could kind of put their face up to little cracks in the wood to get fresh air. Because if you were in the middle of this mass of humanity in the train car, that, you know, there was just very little oxygen. So many people died. They were given like a little bit of bread every day or something like that, that they tried to make last until the bread the next day, which, you know, they may or may not get. So just these deplorable conditions. Eventually, they were taken to a train station where they were kind of transferred to truck and hauled, again, a lot like livestock, no more amenities in these open air, you know, cold weather truck beds, crammed in to try and get a little bit further towards the prison camp that they were headed to. This camp in Eastern Siberia is 400 miles south of the Arctic Circle. So very cold, icy, snowy conditions, low levels of daylight during the wintertime, if any at all. A really desolate destination. Eventually, the trucks couldn't make it any further in that terrain. The trucks just couldn't get through the snow. So the third and final part of the journey to the prison camp was on foot. And this, imagine 4,500 men. They were in shackles, in kind of like a chain gang, two men shackled to each other, just on foot in the snow, headed miles and miles a day to make it to this prison camp.
And what was their footwear like? It probably was completely insufficient.
Yeah, conditions. Completely insufficient. Yeah, this is 1939. you know, the word moccasins is used a lot, and that can mean some different things. But yeah, definitely not winter boot and no winter coat. You know, often men were just wearing kind of like a lightweight, you know, shirt and nothing else.
Wow.
So again, men were continuing to just die. They were dropping like flies. This is basically a death march. And another part of kind of the performance of it all is their captors would say things like, okay, we have first aid responders. So if you're sick or you're hurt or you need help, just let us know and you'll get help from our first aid responders. And what quickly became apparent was that these men, if they were young and healthy and looked like they would be an asset at a hard labor prison camp, if they ran into problems, they would get help. They would get kind of injury care or get a break and allowed to recover from an illness. But if they were older and they didn't look like they were well suited for getting the job.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Done at a prison camp, they would just ignore them and let them suffer and basically fall off the chain gang, you know, dead or near dead, and leave them behind.
Crazy.
Yeah. So after months of this journey, they finally make it to the prison camp, the Gulag, which was known as Camp 303. I think these Siberian prison camps are just labeled by numbers. And it might have to do with the distance from the Arctic Circle. I'm not sure. I'm making that up, but that might be where that number came from. So they get to the camp and there's already about 1,000 men there. And they're at this point about 4,500. I think they started with closer to 5,500, but they're down to 4,500. And they show up and realize that the camp is suited for about 1,000 people.
What?
So the first, yeah, it's much smaller than it's than they're trying to cram all these thousands of extra bodies in. So their first task is to build their own barracks, which is something they're motivated to do, because as soon as this is built, they'll have a wooden plank, you know, bed to lay on and at least a roof over their head. So they get to work, they coordinate, they build their barracks, and they kind of settle in to life at the prison camp. It feels a little bit luxurious as at first, because at least they can be like horizontal when they're sleeping. But and there's wood stoves, wood burning stoves in their quarters, which is new. A heat source. They are eventually given some winter weather gear, hats and mittens and warmer coats, and fed a little bit more because that will keep them working. But you can imagine it's just a miserable life. And they're just going through the motions of this day to day.
What kind of work was being done at this prison camp?
Well, initially, the work was just the building of the barracks. But once that was completed, they were sort of differentiated into different tasks based on what their skill sets were. And Slav was lucky because they asked, if anybody has experience building skis, let us know. And you're going to be a ski builder. And you'll get better rations if you do that. If your skis that you build are suitable to be used by the Soviet Army, they're up to standards, you get a ration increase. And Slav had built one pair of skis once years ago. So he raised his hand and said, yep, that's me. Put me on that team. And he succeeded. So he was building skis. He got some increased rations. And then ultimately, he had this unique skill of working with some electronics, which were new at that time. And the commandant of the prison camp, the big cheese, the guy in charge, had a radio in his home where he lived with his wife, who was the only woman in this entire prison camp, and he needed some repair work done on the radio. So he asked all the men, hey, does anyone know how to do this? And Bob wasn't sure he did, but he said he'd give it a try. Oh. Why not? So Bob volunteered, you know, not sure if he would really be able to or not, but thinking like, gosh, it'd be good to get in this guy's good graces. There may be some benefit, and he needed a challenge and a change of pace. So eventually he was invited into the commandant's home, which was very unusual. He might have been the only prisoner in that camp to ever actually meet the commandant's wife, who lived in this home and, you know, was probably pretty understandably miserable with her lifestyle.
No.
Although seemingly happily married, there was some indication that she sort of willingly moved to this Siberian prison to be with her husband. So,
wow.
So she was up for a little company. And when he would come to work on this radio, which eventually he realized wasn't broken, but he was still being called back to adjust it or even do things like change the channel, move the dial, he would get in long conversations, both with the commandant and his wife, and eventually just with his wife. And there was nothing like nefarious about this relationship that they were developing. It was a kind of a friendly, you know, just connection of two people who had a lot to talk about in regards to the location where they lived and the circumstances that brought them there. So I guess I would say they somewhat befriended each other. And through the course of their conversations, she would ask him things like, don't you ever think about escaping? And I mean, probably also was fully aware that he was an innocent man and maybe developing some respect for him through their interactions. So he kind of got to the point where he was comfortable talking with her about, you know, things like, well, if I were to escape, this might be where I would go, or this might be what I would do, or these are the steps I would take to prepare for it. This big, ongoing, hypothetical conversation about what you would need to successfully escape.
Well, and also it probably seemed like one of those scenarios where you say, Julie, what would you do if you won $10 million in the lottery?
Yeah.
It just seems completely ridiculous and impossible, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's how it started. But the more they talked about it, the more it started to feel like maybe this is doable, to the extent that the commandant's wife ultimately, through, you know, a lot of back and forth where they decided, oh, you would need a team of people. You couldn't do it alone. You'd need really strong, mentally resilient people to join you with varied backgrounds and skill sets. You'd need to hoard resources before you go so that you have a little kind of pack to get you in, at least in the initial parts of the escape. And the commandant's wife eventually was helping him stockpile different resources, food resources, tobacco, which was a big thing then, like more important than food, apparently.
It's impressive,
a theme in this story.
You know.
Yeah, an appetite suppressant, right? Warm weather gear. He started taking some of his daily food ration and hiding it in a location in his barracks where nobody knew that it was, so stockpiling food. And then he started casually talking to people in the camp.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
At calculated moments in interactions about, hey, would you be interested in signing on to this potential escape strategy? And some people were like, no way, you'll never survive. but a handful of people heard him out and ultimately said, yep, I'm with you. If you do it, I'll do it. So after several months of planning, in about April of 1941, he had put together a team of 7 men, so himself and 6 companions. The team included 3 Polish soldiers, a Latvian landowner, a Lithuanian architect, and a U.S. engineer that had been working in Russia and imprisoned for espionage of some kind, all, you know, seemingly falsely accused of their crimes. Blav was 26. He was on the younger end. And the U.S. engineer, who they only ever called Mr. Smith, they never referred to him by his first name, or Smith, he went by his last name. He was the oldest one in the group, but he had a really sharp mind and calm demeanor. And despite his age, which they thought might be a hindrance, ended up being a really important member of their team.
It always helps to have an engineer.
Yeah, exactly. They think in ways that can be helpful in unique situations,
yes,
I found.
For sure.
So the plan was to wait for a blizzard to do a nighttime escape. And they had this all mapped out. They wanted the blizzard so that their tracks would be covered just as soon as they escaped. And it was just this series of really challenging obstacles of crawling through barbed wire and evading guard dogs who did a route around the whole camp. They had to go as soon as they had crossed, you know, their exit point, knowing that the guard dogs wouldn't be back that way for a specific amount of time, which they had calculated previously. So they picked the night. Everybody went to bed. They grabbed their little satchel full of supplies, which wasn't much, and escaped the prison camp. They got caught up in the barbed wire, and there were all these near misses and injuries and cuts and bruises, but they made it. They made it out, and they just took off as fast as they could in the middle of Siberia in a spring blizzard all night long.
Sounds like a vacation.
Yeah. They were just ecstatic. You know, the first obstacle accomplished.
The adrenaline that they must have been experiencing at that point, because I'm sure that if they were caught, they would have been shot, most likely, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolute death if they were caught. And they knew it. And that was kind of the looming threat that the guards and the commandant and everyone involved in the authority of the prison, you know, wielded that threat on an hourly basis,
yeah,
throughout their
So once
existence.
You're out the door, you're pretty motivated to not get caught.
You're motivated. Yeah. Yeah. And they just took off. So here they are now in just deep, snowy, blizzardy, short amounts of daylight, Siberia, and they're generally headed in this kind of southwest direction. Really not sure at this point what's going to come next or what they're going to do or even where they're going. They just know they need to get out of Siberia. Head for Mongolia is kind of like the big picture goal. So at this point, they're traveling 20 to 30 miles per day through this cold weather, and they're not lighting fires because they don't want to be seen. They have very little food, and they did come across several like reindeer that they were able to kill despite not having really any weapons other than an axe. They were able to take an axe, but they came across a reindeer that was kind of tangled up in some brush, and so were able to just basically walk up to it and kill it. And then they had all of this, you know, hundreds of pounds of meat that was a problem because it was evidence. See, they couldn't just leave it there because that would, you know, if it was found, that would point in the direction of where they were going. It was obvious that it had been killed. It was too much to take with them, to carry it on their backs or to store. So, you know, several times when they slaughtered an animal, they decided, well, we just have to stay here and eat as much as we can for maybe a day or two.
Yeah.
To try and dispose of the evidence and also get some nourishment. So they would just like stuff their face with pounds and pounds of meat, which wreaked havoc on their GI tract, and they paid the price for it the next day.
Were they cooking this
meat?
Yeah,
we just trying.
Do they?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I think they cooked some of it. They salted some. Well, I don't know where they would. Maybe they had some salt. But yeah, they were trying to preserve it, and they were able to do it. But they did not evade food poisoning on several occasions.
Oh, no.
They smoked it. I believe they were smoking it as well. So using a variety of techniques. So they're on their way and, you know, they're doing all right. And pretty early on in this journey, something really unexpected happened. They're terrified to encounter another person because they're escaped prisoners and they figure that's going to be a surefire just return to the prison camp and execution. And so within a few weeks, off in the distance, they see a person and their initial instinct is to hide and run the other way. But it's like one of those situations where by the time they realize somebody's there, it was too late. Like they had been spotted, the person had been spotted. And so they're kind of panicking. But on closer approach, it's a young woman all by herself. And it turns out that this young woman, 17-year-old Polish woman, had herself just recently, more recent than them, escaped from a women's prison where she had been in prison doing labor for a period of time as well.
Wow.
Yes. She was 17 years old. Her name was Christina. And at first, of course, she was terrified because this is a group of seven big, bearded, long-haired, dirty, smelly men. And, you know, she is behind enemy lines here, so to speak. But once they realize that she's Polish and they're, you know, majority Polish, it's like she's ecstatic. She feels like, okay, this is my savior here. There's some debate about, well, can we take on a 17-year-old girl? This is going to slow us down. You know, what can we do? We can't leave her. And she's very charming and she's very convincing and she's very strong and strong-willed. So ultimately, they agree. Okay, you're coming with us. And she just pretty instantly becomes a part of their team, a part of their group, and ultimately becomes like a beloved sort of sister daughter, like member of the group. They become really enamored with her and take care of her and give them a really unique purpose in this journey to kind of get her to where she needs to go as well. She had been orphaned. Her parents were both previously murdered and, you know, just a lot of reasons why they wanted to help her.
Well, what's interesting is I have heard in the past that if you have some reason, like someone else to take care of, that you're more likely to make it.
Yes, that's exactly what happened, is they poured a lot of their energy and effort into her, which interestingly, they really didn't even need to do because she was really strong. And one of their concerns was that, hey, can you swim? Because they had to swim across some frozen rivers. One of their concerns was whether or not she could swim because they'd have to swim across some frozen rivers. And she was adamant, I'm a strong swimmer. I can do it. Trust me, I can do it. And she could, and she did. So she stuck with them. She's kept pace with them, and they kept going. So they're making their way out of Siberia. At some point, they cross the border into Mongolia, but they're not sure when and where. I mean, there's no like border crossing. It was a river that they think that maybe they crossed or maybe not. They had no maps. But the further south they got, the more convinced that they were in Mongolia at this point. And then they started running into little villages, groups of Mongols, people that were sheep herding or out on the steppe or the plateau and doing their agricultural work or, you know, hunting and so forth. And that chapter of their journey was just all about the support and help that they received from these random, you know, people from a completely different culture who had no idea who they were, where they were coming from, or what they were doing, but universally just gave them as much food as they could. The sheep herders would slaughter their own sheep to feed them.
Wow.
Make tea, make accommodations for them to sleep overnight. Just very generous and welcoming and supportive and kind of point them in the right direction. So they were still going like days at a time without food, but they were generally surviving on the generosity of these communities that they would encounter few and far between. The next challenge they faced was the Gobi Desert.
Just going from one extreme to the next. As we journey through this difficult story of Slawomir Rawitz and his crew, we find ourselves at a pivotal moment, suspended between the vast expanse of Mongolia and the unforgiving Gobi Desert. It's here that our adventure faces the greatest challenges yet, navigating the treacherous terrain in search of safety. But alas, this is where we must bid you farewell for now. Join us next week as we delve deeper into the trials and tribulations of their epic journey as the saga of the Long Walk continues. Until then, stay tuned, stay curious, embrace yourself for what lies ahead.
Well, thanks for listening today, Casey. And Casey and I want to thank you for your support and spreading the word about the Crux True Survival Stories. If you enjoyed today's episode, take a moment, visit our Instagram page at The Crux Podcast. We encourage you to share our latest posts and your stories and help us reach more fellow survival enthusiasts and storytellers. If you haven't already, please consider leaving a rating and a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback means a lot to us and helps us continue to bring you compelling stories of survival. We'd also love to hear from you if you have any survival stories that you'd like to share or topics you'd like us to explore. Feel free to write us at thecruxsurvival@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for your support.
Thanks for listening.